With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Dairy struggle as milk prices plummet and production costs surge. After earning record-high milk prices last year, dairy farmers have seen their earnings plummet in recent months, with more operations struggling to stay in business and some closing their doors for good. The plight is prompting comparisons to the 2019 economic crisis that forced droves of dairies into bankruptcy. Some say it may be worse this time around due to additional inflationary pressures and higher interest rates that make it more costly for businesses to borrow money. Dairy farmers' costs for feed, labor, fuel, and fertilizers have all skyrocketed. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. NFU on the right to repair issue. National Farmers Union Vice President of Advocacy Mike Stranz explains that the tractor manufacturers have been using language from the Clean Air Act to push back against the right to repair legislation.
One of the arguments that has been made in opposition to allowing farmers the right to repair is that these equipment manufacturers have invoked EPA regulations, particularly the Clean Air Act, as justification for their need to control and restrict repair. The thought being, I guess, that tampering or altering emissions control systems would result if farmers were given the right to repair.
Strong says the NFU has asked the Environmental Protection Agency for clarification on this point, and the EPA, the agency that oversees the Clean Air Act, has responded with a letter on the matter.
We got a letter from EPA Administrator Michael Regan talking about how the importance of right to repair is there, and that using the justification that emissions control systems would be in jeopardy if farmers were allowed the right to repair just doesn't stand up as something with the Clean Air Act. So it was good to get that clarity from EPA that using the Clean Air Act as an excuse for not allowing farmers the right to repair just doesn't hold water.
NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's AgNet West Brian German with more Ag News.
The California Wool Growers Association is set to meet in Paso Robles next week for its 163rd annual meeting and convention. The annual event provides an opportunity for members to participate in educational workshops, discuss issues impacting the industry, and be engaged in association policymaking. The first day of the event will feature a targeted grazing project tour, followed by the CWGA Board of Directors meeting. The second day of the convention will begin with an American sheep industry report, followed by a presentation on carbon marketing for ranchers. There will also be information about adding value with wool certification programs and an update from California Farm Bureau about legislation and policy affecting the industry. Information on AB 888 will also be presented, along with a USDA APHIS Wildlife Services update. More information about the event is available at californiawoolgrowers.org. The Blue Diamond USDA Climate Smart Grant Program is officially underway. Senior Director of Sustainability for Blue Diamond Growers, Dan Sonke, said there are two incentive options that grower members can apply for.
We've rolled out two practices so far to our growers, cover crops and conservation planting. So we're receiving applications for those right now. We are working through some additional paperwork requirements on hedgerows and whole orchard recycling. We hope to launch those soon with our growers. But right now, we're eager to get the applications for cover crops and conservation plantings within the next few weeks as much as possible. There isn't a strict deadline per se, but in order to get the seed ordered, delivered to growers during harvest so that right after harvest they can plant and catch the winter rains, we really need those applications before September 1st, and the sooner the better. That doesn't mean you can't submit an application later, but you'll potentially be forced to wait a year to implement the practices just due to the weather cycle. I will also say there's a first come, first served nature to our funding, so we'll maximize the impact to growers as much as possible as we take applications. And then once the money's gone, it's gone. But we do have an annual cycle and a five-year timeline.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. And stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, as organizations and lawmakers continue to discuss the next farm bill, senators met in the Northern Plains to hear from farmers there during a farm bill roundtable held in Fargo, North Dakota. North Dakota Farm Bureau Director of Public Policy Pete Hannabut spoke about disaster programs.
We don't need to let the farm bill discussion be driven by the perception of the next disaster, because we have chased a lot of disasters, and I'm sure we could find one in every part of the country if we looked hard enough. And so it's a shame that we have that kind of mentality now within the farm bill, that everything becomes a crisis or a disaster, and that's a shame. I would say, the safety net of the things that we're going to talk about with crop insurance and those things are all a huge blessing. But we don't need to make everything applicable to the safety net.
His counterpart, Mark Watney with the North Dakota Farmers Union, had other thoughts.
There's nothing more cool than having a really cool iPhone, but you buy the new one, it doesn't do much more than it used to do, but you like it. Well, farmers are that way, but we need stuff that makes economic sense. So let's get to the point why you're here. The commodity title. It simply is outdated in its price support levels. Whether you look at ARC or PLC, we need to raise those reference prices and the ARC prices. It just needs to be done. To Pete's comment on disaster, the reason we have to do disaster is because the farm bill isn't strong enough to come through when we have price decline or issues that face us. Crop insurance, probably the thing that will get championed the most here, is a really good program. But it does have its limitations on how it pays. And there is some tweaking to do within crop insurance to make that function just a little better, so maybe we can avoid disaster programs.
Watney also proposed a new competition title.
A new competition title. Now, this will be something new. I have to tell a story. The competition, we're not in a free market so much anymore as we used to be. We're not even in a fair market. We have way too much control in the industry, whether it's seed, transportation, fertilizer, just the power of some of these foreign countries that can influence our prices that we have zero control over. My story is Ardent Mills in Florida imported 4 shiploads of wheat come out of Europe. Now, it wasn't hard red spring we grow here. It was hard white spring, or hard red winter wheat grown in Kansas. And I met with the CEO and the CFO, and I said, this is not good. If you can get wheat in here cheaper than we can produce it and ship it to your mills, wheat may become what I call the oats world, where basically we don't produce oats here anymore because you can ship it from Norway and other countries in Canada cheaper than we can produce it here. Well, what was the factor? What made it change that was able to do? It wasn't because they bought the wheat cheaper. It was because the shipping was cheaper, so they could bring it by ship across the Atlantic cheaper than they can bring it on a train from Kansas. We've got to do something about the concentration. We're captive shippers in North Dakota, and we can't sit here and let expenses that are out of our control drive our market and force us into growing things that we probably don't want to grow, especially in western North Dakota. Wheat is still pretty well king. So competition title, something that looks at when companies get massive control where they can influence price and can make us captive shippers or make us pay certain premiums for products, has to be addressed.
Both also discussed conservation and encouraged that programs remain voluntary. Ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, John Bozeman of Arkansas, attended the Farm Bill Roundtable along with Senators John Hoeven and Kevin Kramer of North Dakota. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, National Cattlemen's Beef Association President Todd Wilkinson recently slammed administration overregulation during a recent NCBA Beltway Beef podcast. He said Biden agencies from the EPA to the Bureau of Land Management are trying to take away the cattle industry's freedoms. Wilkinson cites recent EPA statements that it can make minor changes to its Waters of the U.S. rule after the Supreme Court invalidated its central test for a jurisdictional wetland.
Now that we got the Supreme Court weighing in with a clear decision, we still had the EPA trying to impose their regulatory power in terms of, don't care what the Supreme Court says, EPA is going to make up the rules.
And then there's Interior's Bureau of Land Management.
We have the BLM now trying to redefine the grazing legislation that's been in existence for years. They want to put a conservation lease on the same parity with grazing. There's no regulatory authority for that. There's no law authority for that.
Now, other farm groups like the American Farm Bureau have also weighed in against overregulation that Wilkinson sees as a dictatorial approach.
What they can't do legislatively, they're attempting to do by regulation. And if we don't fight back on these regulations, both in the court and legislatively to push back, to defund them, they want to control how you do business, when you do business, and where you do business. And that's just not the way NCBA believes the world should operate.
Now, President Biden and his agency heads are arguing that Americans have the right to clean air, water, and land, which they'll continue to pursue. But producer groups counter that farmers and ranchers are the best stewards of the land and must be to protect their investments for themselves and future generations. In other news, Tyson Foods this week announced the planned closure of four chicken processing facilities here in the U.S. They will close facilities in Arkansas, Indiana, and two in Missouri. The company will shift production to other facilities and cease operations at the impacted locations in the first half of the fiscal year 2024. Tyson made the announcement as part of its third quarter fiscal year 2023 results. The company reported a 7.5% or $324 million operating loss on chicken operations and a 5.6% loss on pork operations. Tyson Foods will evaluate the financial statement impact of the closures for charges related to contract terminations, impairments, accelerated depreciation, severance, and retention. And the Dairy Checkoff marks its 13th year of impact through Fuel Up to Play 60 while preparing a strategy to bring more partners together. Beginning this school year, the checkoff will shift to the Fuel Up platform. The effort will expand opportunities to increase access to dairy with other foods and engage youth around health eating and food production. With the announcement, Dairy Management Incorporated is transitioning from a partnership with the NFL at a no-cost collaboration, which paves the way to create programs that support youth wellness. DMI President and CEO Barbara O'Brien said, "We need to think differently to protect farmers' ability to deliver long-term value to children and in schools." I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The FFA reaches a milestone. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National FFA organization announced a record high student membership of 945,988, which is an increase of 11% from last year. In addition, the number of FFA chapters continues to grow, increasing by 168 this year, resulting in 9,163 chapters in the United States, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. National FFA CEO Scott Stump says, "We are excited to see the enthusiasm for agricultural education and FFA reflected in our membership." The top five membership states are Texas, California, Georgia, Illinois, and North Carolina. This year, the organization has more than 150,000 Latino members, more than 50,000 Black members, and more than 9,000 Asian members, as well as more than 14,000 American Indian and Alaska Native members, and more than 2,400 Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander members. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. It's the time of the year for rodeos, and many states have laws that protect an event sponsor from being sued for injuries from horse-related activities. Most states have enacted equine activity liability acts. The laws are designed to provide the equine industry limited protection against lawsuits. Some state laws are broader and apply to any domesticated animal activity and might even include an employer in an ag employment setting involving livestock. The laws generally require special language in written contracts and liability releases or waivers, require the posting of warning signs, and attempt to educate the public about inherent risks in horse-related activities. As applied to horses, the typical statute covers an equine activity sponsor or equine professional and limits liability to the provision of faulty tack, failure to determine the plaintiff's ability to safely manage a horse, or failure to post warning signs concerning dangerous latent conditions. In one case, the plaintiff visited a horse track that the defendant managed. He was required to get a guest pass to enter the stables, and when he did, he was injured by a horse. The court upheld the immunity provision of the statute on the basis that the requirement to get a guest pass was sufficient protocol to make the visit to the stables an organized activity. Do you know your state's law? This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
For many parents, back to school time is celebration time.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
My goodness, where did this come from? Ooh.
With the kids back to schooling and mothers carpooling and teachers so dear.
So dear. Oh my.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Oh my goodness, that's enough to make you want to cancel school again. But anyway, many parents are preparing so-called brown bag lunches for their kids to take to school, even though most food safety experts do not recommend actually using brown paper bags.
Unless you're using things in your lunch that are totally non-perishable.
You know, apples, peanut butter sandwiches, granola bars, chips, things like that. This from Meredith Carruthers, a food safety expert with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. She says even with a frozen gel pack in a brown paper bag, it's not insulated, and so...
The biggest concern is that those foods aren't going to stay cold enough, and therefore bacteria that can cause foodborne illness are going to start multiplying potentially by the time you go to eat your lunch, and then if you eat your lunch with that bacteria on it that has started to grow, you can potentially get sick, and that's what we don't want.
So try to use a good insulated lunchbox or bag with a frozen cold source. Meredith says with that as a starting point,
you can pretty much take anything for lunch. You just have to make sure you're storing it properly until you're ready to eat it.
Keeping it below 40 degrees. Meredith says that needs to be done even if you're taking leftovers, things like leftover pizza. It's got to be kept cold. So what about, I got an idea. What about taking a chicken leg, you know, something like that, freezing that, using that item as the cold source in the lunchbox? So Meredith, how about that idea? That's your reaction? What's wrong with that?
The big concern is that when that food starts to thaw, those foods will thaw from the outside in. The outer layers of that food, any foodborne illness bacteria that might be present, start to get exposed to that air temperature. And if it's not below 40 degrees, that bacteria can start to multiply. They can multiply to a point of creating toxins that are then heat resistant, won't be killed by reheating, or if your child is eating that frozen food cold, it won't be good and could potentially get them sick.
So keep that in mind. Also, she says we might want to put in that lunchbox or bag some hand sanitizer or hand wipes. So if you have questions about packing a school lunch, any food safety topic, you name it, just call the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-Hotline, 1-888-MP-Hotline. And if you call between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, you'll be able to talk to a live expert, always better than a dead one. You might even get to talk to Meredith, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The grain trade awaits Friday morning's USDA crop report. In the meantime, some agronomists wonder if late season rain is really helping increase corn production. I'm Mark Oppold with the Bottom Line Report at midweek, brought to you by Helena. We're reading more and more reports from agronomists that suggest that early planted corn has begun the final maturation process and beginning to dry down, needing less moisture. In addition, they suggest that while the crop may look healthy from the road, a closer look in the field reveals something different. Significant tip back, smaller ear size, and weaker stalk strength, all signs of that early season stress and the recent rain events that may not be as helpful nationwide as suggested. Now, they quickly add, soybeans are the exact opposite. Late planted soybeans escape most of that heat-related stress and still recovering. As we've said earlier, that pro-farmer crop tour the week of the 21st could be a market mover. This is the Bottom Line Report. Manage in-season nutrition with flexible applications of great products like Coron Metra from Helena. Visit helenaagri.com to learn more. We look for the livestock trade to continue to rebound as we move to the end of the week. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
A leading senator says he won't let conservation programs become mandatory. Ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Senator John Bozeman of Arkansas, doesn't mince words when it comes to conservation programs in the Farm Bill.
That's, you know, we talk about what needs to be included or excluded in the Farm Bill, and that is a red line for me. We simply are not going to get ourselves in a situation where we have a Farm Bill that makes it such that you have to be climate-friendly enough to participate in the risk management tools, conservation-friendly enough. So these need to be voluntary. And that's, again, is so very important. So I want to assure your listeners that if I have anything to do with it, I simply can't support a farm bill that goes down that path.
When asked about the timeline for the new farm bill, Bozeman said he does not expect it to be done by the time the current bill expires in September, but he thinks it could be done by the first of the year. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Rick Zimmerman is Vice President of State Affairs for NCTA, the Internet and Television Association. He talks about how those investments can be used most wisely to help close the digital divide that still exists.
I think there's really three key things from our perspective. One is to really focus on the unserved. Two, to avoid waste, fraud, and abuse. And three, to work with experienced, trusted broadband providers. I think those are the three keys for making this money go a long way.
Zimmerman says there are concrete steps that state leaders can take to ensure that those funds get maximized to deliver high-speed broadband to the unserved as quickly and effectively as possible.
There's a process laid out by the federal government working with the states. Every state has its own broadband office. They have to create a grant process, and there are a number of parameters in the federal statute and the guidelines, but basically it's priority number one, again, the unserved. So there's a map that the feds have created and the states are refining to identify those particular areas. And then two, it's encouraging providers to come in and bid to serve those areas. And three, there is a match requirement, a minimum of 25%, and many providers are going to offer to match an even greater amount, and that will help the money go further to ensure that every unserved area is served.
He says cable broadband providers are good, proven partners for state leaders in closing that digital divide.
Well, we have years of expertise in building, maintaining, upgrading networks. We have built next generation networks across the country. We're available to 85%+ of the country with gigabit download speed, fiber-rich networks, and we also have deep experience with workforce resource management, with supply chain. So that's why cable providers really sort of have a leg up because of that experience.
Rural residents without access to high-speed broadband can take steps to move the process along.
One is that even individual unserved homes are eligible this time around. That's kind of new for these kind of programs. Reach out to your state broadband office. One of the rules here is community engagement, listening sessions. They are supposed to be hearing from everyone, so you should feel free to do that. And local providers also have a wealth of information that they can share and assist. For our part, we are committed to the success of this program, to getting everyone served, and look forward to working with the state broadband officials and individuals to make all of that happen.
Again, that's Rick Zimmerman of NCTA. Chad Smith reporting.
It's a day when a great university and great researchers come together to solve problems.
What Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack referred to is the recent groundbreaking ceremony of a new Platt Science Building on the campus of Washington State University. It is the latest collaboration between the Agriculture Department and the land-grant university in an over 90-year partnership.
It's an incredible gift. So to the extent that we have a university and a government research entity in partnership, ensuring that that farmer and that rancher and that grower and that producer can continue to be productive, it is an enormous opportunity for this country. And each one of us should be thankful at this groundbreaking for the science that will take place that will help those farmers, ranchers, and producers continue to be productive.
The new Platt Science Building will house scientists from both USDA's Agricultural Research Service and Washington State University, as joint research is conducted on various aspects of wheat and legume crops, dry land and irrigated farming, plant germplasm, and sustainable agroecosystems within the Pacific Northwest region. Secretary Vilsack notes how various aspects have not just a regional and national impact, but globally as well.
Imagine a farmer far, far away from here. Imagine that farmer receiving assistance and help because research was done here at WSU that allows them to be able to feed their village or their community. That's what this facility is all about.
The secretary adds the new facility serves as an example of efforts to transform our nation's food system and support ag producers through science, such as the Platt Research Building will provide, and the scientific framework with USDA's recently released 3-year science and research strategy. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have a portion of my interview with Angelina Seha, Vice President at AgSafe. We're talking all about how to stay safe while working outdoors in the heat. One more time, reiterate the time in which heat illness prevention or the standards are required. 80 degrees and then...
So water all the time. Okay. Shade all the time if an employee requests it, right? It's definitely the trigger for having it up is at 80 degrees for the shade.
And then when does the extreme heat threshold hit?
95 degrees.
95 degrees. Got it. Have there been any recent changes to this standard? I know that when I was at your Activate conference, I can't remember what session I was sitting in on, but somebody was talking about water and how maybe, you know, at some point there was one of those big igloo jugs just set out at the end of the field, or at the end of the row of the field. And we thought that was meeting the requirements, but now maybe it needs to be on like a rolling cart and follow the workers as they move up and down the field. So that may be a change. I don't know if that's actually written, but I feel like I remember them talking about something like that. So can you maybe go over some recent changes or things that are maybe talked about as far as amendments to this current standard?
So there was a case recently that was appealed to the Kalosha Standards Board, where further clarification was added as to its language that's a little, can be interpreted in different ways. So mm-hmm. as close as practicable to the employee, which okay. is like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So basically, with the further clarification of that, and for the most part, kind of like the rule of thumb was, you know, it's no more than a 5-minute walk, right? It has to be kind of close, but, you know, sometimes it's not possible. With the clarification is there shouldn't be any obstructions to getting to that water, right? So an employer's responsibility or supervisor, whoever, you know, you've got out there as they're setting up, whether it's the igloo, you know, water jugs, how close can you get it to the employee without obviously causing harm, or that the employee is going to have to, it's not feasible for them to get to that water, right? So if they're having to go under something or over something or across, a field that maybe is dangerous to go across, right? It might be the fastest path, but is it the most practical path, right? Mm-hmm. Can we, and I think that that's where those examples about like maybe putting the water on carts or figuring out another way of like just ensuring that the water is close, right? So that employees aren't having to go spend
longer. Make the
trek
to the water.
Make the trek to the water or possibly even hurt themselves, en route to it. So there shouldn't be obstructions. And that was part of the further clarification. So it wasn't really necessarily a change, but just maybe additional clarification around how practical to have it. In Kalosha, I had some suggestions, which again, I say, you know, every business is gonna look a little different. There mm-hmm. were providing each employee with an individual water jug or having jugs, you know, closer or more of. Every employer is going to have to kind of evaluate what their business situation looks like, and additionally cost as well. There are food safety issues sometimes around having, you know, water physically there, right? Mm. If you're harvesting a crop that maybe is has some food safety, you know, mm-hmm. Restrictions around it, especially with the third party audits. You know, a lot of times it's not allowed for you to be eating or drinking in the field. So, mm-hmm. So while that might feel like an okay, you know, request or not a horrible request, it might not be super practical for that employer right. either, right? So they have to also think about other rules or other requirements that they might have as well for the product. So, so really does kind of put a little bit of onus on the employer to maybe think through, are there ways to get the water a little bit closer to the employees if it's not already, you know, pretty close to them.
Got it.
And then for that person, whoever is out there, supervisor, crew lead, to just ensure that there aren't other obstructions, right, mm-hmm. around where the water looks like it's close, but really it's, I'm going to have to jump over this or go over this to get to, to get to it. So I might not go and get it, right? So
right.
that would be the other,
right.
the other piece,
yeah.
right? So,
yeah. Angelina, I'm so sorry. What might be some tips that employees can take and say, okay, I know it's going to be a hot one, so what are some things that I can do beforehand to prepare and then while out working?
Yeah, so I think one of them, you know, and again, I think that this goes for all of us, is ensuring you're getting a good night's sleep, mm-hmm. Right? So you're well rested. You know, part of it too is how we're dressing in the morning. So making sure that we're wearing like colors that can reflect some heat off. Mm-hmm. And then staying hydrated. So I know my morning routine always includes a cup of coffee. So perhaps I skip coffee and maybe I drink some water, right? So that my body is already starting to get hydrated, right? For the day ahead. And then really I think having, hopefully your employer is paying attention to some of these things as well. It's just ensuring that they're doing the heaviest work earlier in the day, right? So that might also mean their employer starting a little bit earlier in the day to just ensure that we're getting, you know, the tasks done that we need to get done earlier in the day before it starts to get really hot. And just depending on the part of the state that you're in, valley heat hits us kind of later in the day, whereas in the coast, it hits them a little earlier. So I think it's also just, you know, again, paying attention to those things. And then if you're not feeling good, it's, you know, informing your supervisor, right, that you're not feeling good. But I think just some practical tips are just, you know, light clothing, getting rest, drinking water.
Okay. You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Organic fresh produce sales are up 1.5%. Organic fresh produce grew slightly in sales dollars and volume in the second quarter of 2023, reversing a trend of volume loss seen in 2021 and 2022. Overall, organic fresh produce dollar sales increased by 1.5% for quarter two of 2023 compared to the same period last year, with sales for the quarter topping $2.4 billion. Volume movement nudged up slightly less than 1%, reversing a downward volume trend that started in 2021. During the second quarter, conventional produce dollar sales grew by 2% while volume declined by 1.3% as total sales topped $18.8 billion. The Organic Produce Network and Category Partners reports, quote, "The rate of organic sales growth, while still positive, slowed compared to past years, giving volume a chance to match that growth." In the second quarter of this year, 11 of the top 20 organic fresh produce categories posted increases in dollar sales compared to the same period last year. And AFB contributed to that report.
What's going on in the wheat market? It's been an up-and-down run in the wheat market in recent months. Kim Anderson, a grain market economist with Oklahoma State University Extension, talks about the latest in the wheat market.
Well, if you look on what's going on with prices, we've had quite a dip. You go back to June 1, we was running around $7.50, wallered around plus or minus 60 cents or so until we got to mid-July, and then we had that report. Exports in Russia had plenty of wheat production on the market. Then they were going to stop the exports out of Ukraine. We got an increase up to $8.50. We've now taken about $1.40 off of that.
Anderson says it's important to keep an eye on what's going on with Ukraine's wheat.
I think it's important that we watch what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. I think right now what they're saying is that we're going to get that wheat out of there. I think you need to remember that we're expected to harvest a 29.3 billion bushel world crop. That's a record.
Recent wildfires of note. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey discusses some of the significant wildfires in the western U.S. over the past 3 weeks.
The largest U.S. wildfire to date is the York Fire. It's a fire burning in a desert area near the California-Nevada border. As of early August, we've seen approximately 94,000 acres of desert vegetation burned by that wildfire. One of the more interesting fires that we've seen in recent days crossing the international border. That's the Eagle Bluff Fire, which started in northern Washington and then proceeded to burn northward into British Columbia, Canada. That fire required rare coordination between international agencies fighting the fire to discuss how to approach the firefighting efforts as it's crossed the international border. It only burned a little over 2,000 acres before being mostly contained, but it burned through a populated area, unfortunately, and also a campground. According to latest numbers, we saw more than 36 residents and several dozen more outbuildings destroyed by that fire.
The 9th International Olive Symposium is coming up in September in Davis. Organized by UCANR, UC Davis, and the International Society for Horticultural Science, the 2023 Olive Symposium will be taking place September 10th through the 14th at UC Davis. An opening session will kick off the symposium on September 10th, with the program starting the next morning with a table oil industry keynote session, followed by a discussion on breeding and genetics, along with a tasting at the UC Davis Olive Center. The second day of the symposium will cover physiology, climate change, planting systems, and pruning, along with irrigation, fertilization, and soil management. September 13th will feature presentations on crop protection, harvest, and olive products and marketing. The final day of the symposium will feature field tours of several olive operations. More information about the symposium is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Gas and diesel prices move higher again. The nation's average gas price of gasoline rose 7.8 cents last week to $3.79 per gallon, and diesel jumped 14.9 cents to $4.14 per gallon. The increases followed the rise in oil prices and pressure from hot weather that impacted refineries. However, the pace of increases has started to slow and appears to have peaked over the weekend. And it's beginning to gently fall. That's according to Gas Buddy's Patrick DeHaan. The fuel market expert says, quote, diesel will likely continue to see upward momentum while gasoline price increases should become more limited. The price of crude oil has rallied for six straight weeks. In recent days, fundamentals have remained solidly in control behind the upward move, as Saudi Arabia continues its severe 1 million barrel per day production cut, driving prices higher. In addition, government data last week showed the largest weekly decline in U.S. crude oil inventories on record. NAFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.